We're going to be in two different passages today. The first one is from your Old Testament, so I encourage you to open to Exodus chapter 34 and look at that with me. Exodus 34. You know, we are very blessed in this age to live in a time and place where we can communicate over very long distances in a very short amount of time using a large amount of devices and methods available to us. This is a pretty unique time of history because for thousands of years, if you wanted to communicate with somebody living in a different part of whatever empire or country you were living in, you had to, unless you were going to go yourself, you had to send a messenger to go speak words in somebody else's ear, or you sent a letter from point A to point B. But now, with the invention of cell phones and phones in general, computers, we can hear each other's voices from across the country. We don't have to just send paper mail. We can now send electronic mail. And with the push of a button, as I was able to do yesterday on my iPhone, I can see the faces of my parents who live in Houston, Texas. I mean, we have all kinds of ways to communicate. And that is a huge blessing. But isn't it interesting that with all of these things available to us, we still value face-to-face interactions, don't we? It's why business trips still happen. It's why people get on planes and travel far away from their home to some other location so that they can meet with clients or other people in their business face-to-face to get jobs done. I've heard Steve talk many times about that's why he flies to Asia or Europe or some of these other places he goes to, because nothing beats that. A Zoom call, that's a good thing to do, just cannot be an adequate substitute for seeing somebody right across the table from you. That's why when it comes time for Thanksgiving or Christmas or some other family holiday, you know, if you have family living in another place, you will visit them. You will go to them so that you can be in the same living room, across from the same kitchen table from them. And I think this side of COVID, all of this point has really been made very clear to us. The isolation from other people when you can't see their faces right there in the room with you, that's just really hard to communicate in the right kind of way, because our relationships are built on face-to-face interactions. You know, we depend a lot on not just the words coming out of people's mouths, but we depend on being able to see their facial expressions, to be able to hear the tone in their words, to be able to gauge from their whole body language what they are communicating. It's not just what they're saying. I think all of that makes our relationship with God kind of interesting, though, because none of us have ever seen God. We don't have a face-to-face relationship with the God that we have come here to worship, with the God that we serve on a day-to-day basis in our weeks. We can read letters from Him. We can open up this book that He's put into our laps, and we can look at the thoughts that He's communicating to us, and we can talk to Him. We can pray to Him and have full confidence that He listens to our words and our voices. But no human has ever seen God's face, at least not in the fullest form. But that's why Jesus is so important. Because as Mo talked about this morning, and as the bulletin article is kind of getting at, if you see Jesus, you have seen the face of God. And so what I want to do today is look at two different passages, one from Exodus 34 and one from 2 Corinthians 3, to help us appreciate, as we come to the Lord's Supper table, the face of Jesus and how we can look at Him and how that can change us ahead of time in anticipation of the day when we truly will be at His throne and truly will be gazing at Him face to face. So let's look at Exodus 34 first, then 2 Corinthians 3, to talk about how we must look at Jesus in order to look like Jesus. Exodus 34, I want to read 29 through 35 with you. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand as he came down from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. Aaron and all the people of Israel saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, all the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken with him at Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. Whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the veil until he came out, and when he came out and told the people of Israel what he was commanded, the people of Israel would see the face of Moses, and the skin of Moses' face was shining. And Moses would put the veil over his face again until he went in to speak with him. So, a couple of things I want to notice with you from this passage. And the first one is this, that Moses was visibly changed by his personal interactions with God. And this connects us all the way back to chapter 33. Because back there, remember, Moses and God have a conversation together. Moses wants to see God's glory, which God interprets as, you want to see my face. And so God says, well, you can't actually see my full glory, my face, because no man can actually handle that. You would die. But what I can do is I can hide you in this rock over here, and I can put my hand over you, and you can see my glory as it passes by the rock. And so he could see God to some extent. And notice what happens here. Obviously, in chapter 34, he is seeing God's glory because he's coming down from the mountain a changed person. He doesn't look the same as he does when he's just on the ground level talking with the Israelites as he normally would. I think it's interesting what the reaction of the people is. When Moses comes down, they don't go, you know, I think there might be something different about you. You know, it says in the text that as he descended, they all ran away from him. Even his brother, even Aaron, who had some interactions with God himself, and God spoke through him, even that man ran for the hills until Moses finally said, no, 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 it's just me, guys, come over, I'm not going to kill you. You know, you're not going to be hurt by me. But there was a terror, there was a sense of, whoa, what happened to you? And don't you think it's interesting that Moses himself seemed to be unaware of the changes that were happening to him? It says in the text, he did not know personally that his face was shiny like that. It's kind of like when you're in a lit room, and there's all kinds of light in the room. You don't think much of it. Your eyes adjust to that. But if somebody is coming into a brightly lit room from the dark, you know, they're squinting, they are having trouble adjusting to it in a way that you've already gotten used to. That's kind of the sense I get from this picture. And so he's coming down with the tablets, the second pair of tablets. And just like the people can't take hearing the voice of God when God spoke the Ten Commandments to them at Mount Sinai, they also can't take the glory that is being shown, not from God, but from the face of Moses as Moses talked with God. Very indirect kind of glory. But they can't take that either. And I think this is the reason why. It's because of the hardness of their hearts. And so they needed a veil over Moses' face so that they could handle interactions with him because of what was going on inside of them. Look at these verses that I put up on the boards. Let's back up a second in the text. Chapter 32. This is the chapter of the golden calf, so there's a lot going on here in the context. But look at verse 9. The Lord said to Moses, I've seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Therefore, let me alone that my wrath will burn. Chapter 33. in verse 3, the Lord is giving instructions to Moses. He's telling him, you know, I want you guys to go into the land. I'm going to send an angel there to help you with that. But I'm not personally going to go with you because of your condition. Look at verse 3. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people. Verse 5, same thing. Lord said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. If for a single moment I should go up among you, I would consume you. So now take off your ornaments that I may know what to do with you. And then finally, chapter 34 in verse 9. Moses is worshiping God there. In verse 9 he says, if now I found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance. So God calls them that. Moses calls them that. That is an interesting image, is it not? Think about somebody who has a stiff neck. What are they unable to do? If this is the only position that their neck can go in, they cannot bow their heads, right? They cannot humble themselves in front of the God that they're supposed to be serving. You know what's so ironic about that? Isn't that exactly the way their former master was? Isn't Pharaoh, if you look at the Exodus stories, before Pharaoh finally, after the 10th plague on Egypt, finally says, you guys can go, you can leave the land, you can go where you want to go. He was talked about in the same kind of way. Except the expression that's often used for Pharaoh is, he's hard-hearted here. He hardened his heart against the Lord. But it's the same exact idea as what's being talked about with God's people. This sense of, I understand what the Lord is saying, sort of, but I don't care to follow it. I don't want to do what he says to do. I'm going to go my own way. Thank you very much. And so, that's why when Moses came down from the mountain, they needed a veil to stand between them and the Lord and Moses. We'll talk more about that when we get to 2 Corinthians. But I want to go now with you to that passage. I want to read it with you, 2 Corinthians 3, 7 through 18. And we'll begin to work our way through this text and appreciate what God has to say here. So if you would go to your New Testaments now, and let's read this together. 2 Corinthians 3, in verse 7. Now if the ministry of death, carved in letters on stone, came with such glory that the Israelites could not gaze at Moses' face because of its glory, which was being brought to an end, will not the ministry of the Spirit have even more glory? For if there was glory in the ministry of condemnation, the ministry of righteousness must far exceed it in glory. Indeed, in this case, what once had glory has come to have no glory at all, because of the glory that surpasses it. For if what was being brought to an end came with glory, much more will what is permanent have glory. For we have such a hope. We are very bold, not like Moses, who would put a veil over his face so that the Israelites might not gaze at the outcome of what was being brought to an end. But their minds were hardened. For to this day, when they read the Old Covenant, that same veil remains unlifted, because only through Christ is it taken away. Yes, to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their hearts. But when one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. Now the Lord is the Spirit. And where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. I think we get some really interesting points out of this passage. And the first one is this. Since Jesus' brightness is not temporary, like the glory on Moses' face was, it is superior to what is going on there in Exodus 34. So Paul gives us a little bit more insight into why Moses puts on a veil. It wasn't just because the Israelites are scared of his glowing face, although that's part of it. It's because the way, and I think it's pretty clear, verse 13, I think the most straightforward way to read that is, the glory on Moses' face is diminishing as he comes down from the mountain, and so Moses is not bold about that. Paul talks about that right there. And so he feels like he's got to put this on out of this embarrassment about what is happening to his face. And so Paul is making a point here about the old covenant and how that was being brought to an end. That was diminishing. That was going away, even though in Exodus 34, it is the very beginning of the old covenant. That's the point in time where God first gave the law of Moses to the Israelites there that they would use for hundreds of years. And yet, even at that point, this, what is happening to Moses' face is an indicator, it is a red flag that this covenant that they were establishing between God and the Israelites was not going to last. Just like the glory on Moses' face was not going to last. And so he put a veil on to hide that diminishing presence of that light. And so Paul talks about this, verse 7. Being brought to an end, the glory on his face. Verse 10, what once had glory has come to have no glory at all, because that covenant is no longer in effect anymore. Verse 11, for if what was being brought to an end came with glory, then how much more is the glory that we have in Jesus Christ? What Paul is doing here is a lot like what the Hebrew writer will often do. He'll make an argument from the lesser to the greater. Well, if this is true, how much more is this true over here? If there was glory on his face back there with the covenant that they had, how much more glory is there for us to look at in Jesus? Because Jesus is not going to fade away. His throne is not going to diminish. He is always going to be there at the right hand of God. And so we can have a boldness that Moses did not have, and that the Israelites did not have because of the situation there. Do we understand and appreciate how neat this is? So I think we can go further about this. So I think the text is trying to help us understand that then if we're not gazing at Jesus' glory, then nothing else is going to make sense. I think Paul talks about in verse 14 the mindset of the Jews that he's trying to work with day after day, town after town, part of the Roman Empire after part of the Roman Empire. Notice what he says, their minds were hardened, but not just them, not just that generation, because he says, for to this day, when they read, the Jews read the Old Covenant, that same veil remains unlifted, because only through Christ is it taken away. The people of Paul's generation were just as stiff-necked, if not more so, than those Jews back there. Remember in Acts chapter 7, when Stephen preaches his whole sermon, at the end of Acts 7, he calls them this same phrase, stiff-necked. And then they go on to prove his point by hauling him out of the city and stoning him to death, and not listening at all to the message of Jesus that he was trying to help them understand so that their lives could change. So the Jews read Scripture, and all kinds of people today read the Scriptures. But if they're not interested in gazing at Jesus' glory, these Scriptures are just going to be an interesting ancient artifact, a piece of world literature that we should read, but doesn't really make me want to follow it unless we're actually looking at Him and appreciating how everything comes together in Jesus Christ. Amen. And so if we reach a point where you and I don't believe much anymore in the cross, in Christianity, in this whole working for Him business, the way that we get there is precisely because we're not gazing at Jesus' glory. We're gazing at something else. I'm going to tell this story. We're several years removed from this. Long time ago here, we had a couple visiting with us from a different state. I'm not even sure where they were from anymore. And they came in, and I greeted them, and I asked them, "So what brings you to our neck of the woods?" And they said to me, "Well, we're actually here to visit our son. Our son is going to such and such nearby university in this area, and he's not walking with the Lord right now. And so we're here to try to encourage him and try to be a little bit of a prod to him to try to get his faith back." And then they explained their take on why their son is not faithful. They said to me, and I didn't even like ask them questions about that, they just volunteered this. They said, "When our son was in high school, he had a high school Bible class teacher who messed up a class and planted doubts in our son's mind, and that's why our son is the way that he is this day, why he's not faithful to the Lord." And I didn't say anything during that conversation, but in my head I'm thinking, that may have been a contributing factor, but that is not the core issue of why your son is not walking with the Lord. The core issue is, he wasn't gazing at Jesus. Now, I can understand some logic to that. You know, we get discouraged when we look around at other people sometimes. And, you know, this person's not faithful, and this person's not faithful, and they're not doing what they should be doing, and they explained that passage really poorly, and that's hard for me, and that was painful for me to experience. I mean, we can understand that. But it's a whole other thing to say, "And I'm not walking with Jesus because of all those people. It's because I looked around me and I saw disappointment." Well, that's the problem. You looked around instead of looking up. But it's easy to do, isn't it? And I'm not trying to drag that couple through the mud. I think all of us, if we have discouraged moments, all of us can think that way. "Well, I'm not doing, maybe I'm not as faithful as I should be, but it's because of this person and this situation and that." Well, contributing factors, yes. But the bottom line is, you're not going to be faithful unless you look at Him. Now, on the flip side, isn't it encouraging that the way people come to Jesus is they look at Him and not at us? Now, for those of us who are trying hard to try to teach and to try to reach out and to try to encourage and try to help pull people into the faith of Jesus, I don't know about you, but I spend far too much time worrying about the words that I say. Or were they exactly the words that should have been said in that moment to help this person? And what we need to do is take a step back and rely on His power and His glory to do the heavy lifting for us. It's not up to us to bear burdens that we were never meant to bear in the first place. Think about this. Stephen and Peter, in some ways, preach the exact same lesson. Acts 2, Acts 7, you know what they have in common? Both of those guys said, "You killed the Messiah." Both of them said that. But both of those guys had two very different reactions, right? In Acts 2, people went, "Oh, we killed the Messiah. Oh no, is there any hope for us? Oh, forgiveness and washing away our sins in Jesus? Yeah, I'll take that." In Acts 7, "How dare you? We're going to take you out back and kill you for that." It did not depend on the smoothness of the words of those preachers, of those teachers. It depended on the hearts of the people who are being taught. Are they interested in gazing at Jesus' glory or not? That's really what it comes down to. when all is said and done. A person has to have the heart to submit to Jesus before the message can penetrate. And yes, we should have our language sprinkled with salt, as Colossians says that we should. We should be thoughtful and not clueless about the way that we talk and the way that we spread the message. But the weight is not on us. The weight is on whether or not people want to see Jesus or not. But this is such a message that I think God's people of all ages have needed to understand. You ever thought about Elijah recently? Remember in 1 Kings 18 and 19, you have the contest in Mount Carmel. You have everybody falling down and saying, "The Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God," but then nothing happens. And then Elijah gets incredibly discouraged. He runs all the way down to Mount Sinai, by the way, and he prays to God, or he talks to God after God comes down and says, what are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah says, "I'm the only one left. Everybody else is doing their own thing, serving idols." And remember what God's reaction to him is? Well, first of all, Elijah, you're not by yourself. There's actually a whole lot more people than you who are worshiping me. But even if that were true, you look to me. I have jobs for you to do, and it is your job to go out there and to do them. Gaze at my glory, was the message to Elijah. I think we can all relate to that at some points in our lives. Let that be encouragement to us. Third point I want to make from this passage is that we are permanently changed the more that we stare at Jesus. Moses was only temporarily changed. He went up on the mountain, he gets the commandments, the glory of God shines on his face, and to some extent or another, he comes down and that glory continues on his face for a while, and that cycle would kind of go over and over and over again. But the more that you and I look at Jesus, the more permanently he is etched onto our souls, so that we become not different creatures, but we become more and more into the same image. Did you notice how the text is talking about that? We're transforming into the same image, to the image of Jesus. And isn't that what we are created to be? People in the image of God. Now, how does that happen? Well, I think verse 17 and 18 helps us understand that. What does it mean that after he says that when you turn to the Lord, the veil's removed? And then he says, the Lord is the Spirit. And where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. I think the Holy Spirit, we can learn a lot from him in a lot of different kinds of passages. He's a different person than Jesus, than the Father. But the Lord is the Spirit is a way of saying when you have one working in your life, you automatically have the other. When you look at Jesus and you gaze at him and you go to him for glory, for something to look at, then you have the Spirit working in your life. Because it's almost like the two are the same, even though they're not. They work hand in hand with each other. Now, what does it mean to have the Spirit of the Lord? Well, you go back to the very first part of Genesis. Where do you see the Spirit? You see him hovering over the face of the waters right before God transforms the darkness into light and separates the two out from each other. So that's what's being talked about here, is God changes you through the Spirit when you have the Son working with you. All this comes, this one degree of glory to another, this transformation, verse 18, all this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. And that will prevent us from having hardness of heart the more that we look at him. So, again, I want to go back to this point that we talked about at the very beginning, that I think both of these passages are pointing to. The more that you look at Jesus, the more that you will become like Jesus. someday all of us really will come into God's presence and see the face of God. 1 John says that. Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when He appears, we shall be like Him because we shall see Him as He is. Now, we have not laid physical eyes on the Son or the Father or the Spirit yet, but our spiritual eyes can go to the foot of the cross. And that is the value of what we do every week with the Lord's Supper, is we are invited by Jesus to come gaze at Him. Not to look around at the other people around us and to compare our lives to theirs and to see, am I more spiritual than you or you than me? Or play any of the silly games that sometimes we like to play in our minds. We're invited to gaze at Him, at what He did for all of us, so that we can become outward-looking servants instead of selfish comparison people. This is where He changes our spirits, when we see the cross. Because that sacrifice is meant to be the foreshadowing of what He wants all of our lives to look like. All of us are called by Him to take up our crosses, to follow Him the way that He has served us. So I invite you now, as I'm coaching myself, to look at Jesus now so that we can all leave this place looking more like Him a little bit more than when we came in this room today. Let's take the supper together now.